Accession number 27083, reel 35.
Sir Henry, you've been bitten by an oyster.
And the mere thought of food was nauseating. But by lunchtime I thought, I ought to make it if I possibly can. And so I got a taxi and I went up to Vacozzi's nice house, only to find that they had been adversely affected by the reservoir bursting its banks, and their water was cut off, and they had about half a cistern left for the loo, which were therefore reserved for the girls. And if the men guests required anything, they had to go behind the hedge at the bottom of the garden. That didn't sort of inspire me with increased confidence. And of course it was Spain, and although we foregathered at 1 or 1:15, it was 4 or 4:15 before we made any attempt to sit down to lunch. And by this time I was feeling definitely queasy again, worse not better. And we went in, and I remember the entree was some sort of egg dish in cream and large orange blobs, the yolk of the egg, was floating in this quite thick cream. And I love that sort of thing. And I thought it would have been delicious. But the mere sight of it was the last straw for me. And I turned to my host, who was near my end of the table, and said, "Look, I'm frightfully sorry. I don't think I can face it. I think I'm going to have to go. I shall only disgrace myself." And he kindly rang up for a taxi. And as soon as it arrived, I left. By the skin of my teeth, too. I got the taxi to drive me down, and I'd completely forgotten that the ship was open to visitors. And the whole of the jetty alongside which we were was covered with a huge crowd, all sort of queuing to get on board the one gangway and that sort of thing. And it would have been perfectly easy just to sort of hop over the guardrails and hop on board. But if I had done, so would have several hundred others. So that wasn't on. And I had to queue, because you couldn't push around, for the unlikely requirement to get back on board my own ship. And I made it eventually, just in time. That was Barcelona. From where we went on to Alicante as a squadron. And there, again, it was a usual sort of thing, but with a difference. We had a perfectly normal and perfectly nice lunch with the mayor, but there were, and he was one actually, as he joined the competition by then. He and two local dignitaries ran a competition as to who would provide the best lunch to the visiting UK ships. And he was one competitor, and he did all right, but it was very ordinary, very charming lunch. And then there was the manager of a German restaurant a little further down the coast that specialized in fish. And he was another competitor for who was going to provide the finest lunch. I never quite heard who was going to be the arbitrator on this, but there it was. Well, we'd dealt with the Lord Mayor, or with the Mayor, and we went to the German restaurant, and we hung around for quite a bit, drinking, and then we sat down, and we had, I think it was, I mustn't exaggerate, it was 7 or 8 courses of different sorts of fish. 7 or 8 courses. And the last course, the eighth or ninth, consisted of a sort of paella, saturated in the juices of all the previous courses. Well, we got through that, all right. And then we had a glass of brandy, and then we were taken to be shown the latest hotel, German, again, where a rather more formidable glass of brandy was produced. By this time, we'd rather had it, but we got by, and that was the end of that day. And the third occasion, we went to in the opposite direction, to a tiny little fishing village, and there was a pretty basic-looking hut, and there were a couple of fishing boats drawn up on the beach, tiny harbour. And we were ushered into this funny, very long hut-type building, and there was a great long table, hugely long, with plates set for lunch, and lots of knives and forks and things, and lots of glasses. And everybody standing, both sides, rather canteen chairs, quite a narrow table, not much wider than that. And nothing happened. This again was about 1 o'clock or so. And we turned to our hosts, who I think all spoke a little English, and we spoke no Spanish. And eventually somebody came along with a bottle of sherry, and then somebody else came along with a bowl of olives, and we thought, things are looking up. But by then it was 1:30 at least, and we sipped our sherry and we munched our olives, and then around came the bottle of sherry again, and along around came the bowl of olives, and this went on. And about 2:30, a good hour later, we were beginning to rather want to sit down, apart from anything else. And it was made quite clear that despite everything having been laid there, that was not going to be where we were going to sit and have our lunch. And we were eventually, I can't remember what time it was, but it was getting on for 3, I think, we were taken to an entirely other room and seated at another table, where we had a single course, and it was a monstrous paella, which was on sort of huge dishes, not an ordinary plate, and mound high. And we had to wade through this. And we eventually crawled out at about 4:30. And to this day, I don't know who won the competition. Then we returned to the UK, and we were going to go...
As a squadron.
What?
As a squadron.
As a squadron, yes. And we were going to... we went to Portland for a week, just to sort of sharpen up efficiency, because we hadn't done all that much out in the Med, the serious stuff, weapon training and the like. And we still had, I suppose, a month or more to go before we were going to recommission, and all the CAs would change and so forth. And we went to Portland, and one of our commanders, also driving a battle, was a bit of a flash aleck. He's dead now, poor chap. But he was the sort of chap that when he went ashore to a restaurant, reckoned that he could play the drums better than the band, and he would take over the drummer's job. That sort of thing. He was very full of himself. He was actually an extremely nice man, but he was rather a flash aleck. And he thought he'd do a smart alongside, and he was going alongside the leader, the Captain D, who was a charming little man. Short and dumpy, very cheerful, very good Captain D. And this this rather extrovert fellow used to despise him and say, well, he's a joke, he'd never get anywhere. He actually became a rear admiral eventually and then had a brain tumour, and that was the end of him, sadly. This other chap retired as a commander. But there it was. And he thought, well, you know, I'll teach this fellow how to come alongside of the straw. And he didn't get it right. And he tore an enormous gash in the leader's forecastle. As a result of which, he was not able to go to Helsingborg, which the rest of the squadron was going to do. And this upset him acutely, upset Captain Dee even more. In fact, he was able to go to the perpetrator, because he'd done it really with his bow, and although he'd buckled it a bit, he was entirely watertight. And he was three places up in the Navy list from me. I was boots of the three of us. And the two of us went off to Helsingborg. And he went in by his first, and I went in having learnt my lesson in Heraklion. I did a sternboard so that I was ready to get out, and so on. And on the way there, he of course called the tune as to what course we steered and that sort of thing, and we were in close company. And he put us straight over a shallow patch. And it was quite clearly marked on the chart as a shallow patch. And I discussed it with my navigating officer, who was a very good one, and we decided that no way were we going to go over that patch. And so we started with more or less courteous signals saying attention is drawn to, and that sort of thing. Didn't want to ruffle him unduly. And got answers back saying, not shown in my chart, and that sort of thing. To which there was only one answer, well, it's shown in mine, and don't intend to go over it. Which eventually forced him to make an alteration, of course. But I think by then I'd started to alter course. I mean, he left it till the last minute and so forth. And there were various little things like that when he was being a bit too big, the big shot, and not getting it right. And so on. And we had a visit there, which was fairly unremarkable. And we left and came back home. I went to our respective base ports, and I went back into Devonport for the last time in Dunkirk, and handed over to my successor, and went off on leave. And I had been appointed, I think I already knew, then I'd been appointed to do a ship air squadron command exam, to revise the exam. And that was going to take, I think I was given 3 months for it. And then I was appointed to the Joint Services Staff College, which was then housed at Latimer. And that was the end of my time in Dunkirk.
Well, Sir Henry, before we leave Dunkirk, I do have one question. You just touched on the descriptive qualities of your Captain Dee, and you said that he was quite a good Captain Dee. What are the qualities that are required in a captain of a flotilla?
A squadron.
Of a squadron, whether it be of frigates or destroyers or whatever. What are you looking for over and above that of being captain of a ship?
First, professionalism. You expect him to know everything about everything. Now, no human is in quite that category. But you expect him to be thoroughly professional. And that, as often as not, is helped by experience. Second, you expect him to have a sense of humour, without which he will be lacking in a sense of proportion. So concentrate on the things that matter and don't fuss too much about trivia. Third, you expect him to be, how shall I put it, in readily available human touch, and therefore in a position to encourage you to discuss your own officers, particularly if you have problem ones, and the chances are that you've got one or two, and come to that, the same could go for sailors. I could go on. You've got to have, obviously, a personality. You've got to have you've got to have power of command and so forth. But, for example, the man I've just been referring to, who tore a hole in his Captain D's forecastle, he was forever going around saying there are no characters these days, and setting out to be a character. Up to a point, he was a character, but he was a bogus character. He wasn't a natural.
He was not.
And he was acting the whole time. And Jack will see through that in a flash. Have I said enough?
Yes. Thank you. Thank you. So if you're ready, Sir Henry, we'll... if you want a break, we'll have a break. Otherwise, we'll move...
How much have we got at this one?
We're halfway through this tape.
Should we go for finishing that off? We certainly finish the next thing off, and then we've got a long one.
Okay.
Well...
You're going to the Joint Staff College.
I'm going to the Joint Services Staff College at Latimer. And my ship and our squadron command exam, which was a two-man band, and I had an aviation commander with me, that work was done in the Admiralty, and I can't remember where I stayed. I think one did it on a weekend basis, I think, and I went back home for weekends and so forth. But I managed to get a quarter at Latimer, which was unusual for a student. The directing staff had quarters, and if they had a few spare, then they were happy to hand them out. And I was lucky, because I was there in very good time before the course started. Well, the ship command, ship and squadron command exam revision, I couldn't stretch more than 6 weeks out of the 3 months, possibly. I mean, it was a piece of cake, really. We had to get it right, but it wasn't difficult. And then there was a considerable delay, a matter of weeks, while it was typed up and printed and so forth. First it had to be approved, and then it had to be promulgated in an Admiralty Fleet Order and all the rest of it. And so, beyond scrutinizing the final draft, as it were, and nobody fiddled with it, the thing was finished. And off I went to Latimer, into the quarter, with my wife and only girl at the time, and got to know people there, and did a bit of gardening, and so forth. And I haven't really very much to say about the JSSC. It lasted for, give or take, 6 months. It was a slightly odd course. In terms of security, it was pretty well limited to confidential, because it had supposedly up-and-coming people of all three services and of many different nationalities. So we had an American, we had a Ghanaian, I remember, we had an Indian, we had a Pakistani, we had Uncle Tom Cobble and all. It was headed, the whole outfit was headed by a rear admiral. He had at captain's level. He had a naval captain, a group captain, and an army colonel, and they had, at commander's level, others below them. You operated in syndicates of about eight or a dozen. Also, you joined together for lectures. You did various schemes. It was a good updating, I put it no more strongly. It wasn't basic staff work, because you were supposed to have hacked that already, and so you should have done by then, and so on. It was interesting. It was enjoyable. And having our quarter, and not having a house of our own, we used that at home, occasionally went off the odd weekend and that sort of thing.
Where did your wife live when you were in command of the Dunkirk?
She came out to Gib when we did the refit.
Yes.
And she came on to Malta, where we managed to get her. We took over a friend's little house there for the rest of the time in Malta, which was about a year or so.
So, in fact, you had a very good and happy family life, immediately accessible when you were not actually at sea.
Yes. But I'm afraid this circumspectly. I mean, I think I got to Malta first, for example. I certainly got to Gibraltar first and had a bit of a fling round to find somewhere to live. But I did, eventually. And then in Malta, I met her and got her to the house in time for breakfast from an early flight. And I had breakfast there with her on the morning of her departure. And she went back overland before I did. But Brown saw each other of an evening, and we went to such social events as one did go to. We went together and that sort of thing. No complaints at all. It was good. The commandant at Latimer, when I went there, was a sailor called Jack Scatchard. And I'll say little more about him because we come across him later on. He was not an intellectual. He was a bluff sailor. He was a salt horse. That's to say, he was not a subspecialist. He was inclined to raise his elbow. His value to the course, because he never, at the end of somebody's lecture, he never attempted to sum up a few key points and knock them about before opening up questions and so forth. He always had a standard format and would say, well, I'm sure we'd all like to thank so-and-so very much for his most interesting delivery, blah, 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 and then it was question time. So he didn't really contribute much to the course. Out of the lecture room, he would entertain, because he had to, for lunch or dinner or whatever, he would entertain the visiting lecturer in a way that he thought appropriate. And so, for instance, when Dennis Healy came down, as, I suppose, Defence Secretary then, he didn't approve of Dennis Healy or what he was doing, and he pinned him in a corner and figuratively hacked him in the slats. And he didn't give a fig what he said to them. Well, that was entertaining stuff, and that was good. We developed...
But that would be some years on, of course, from where we are now. That will be some years on from where we are now, because Dennis Healy didn't become Defence Secretary until the end of 64.
You're quite right. I think Defence... What would he have been before?
He would have been in the opposition in some capacity.
Then it probably wasn't Dennis Healy I'm thinking of. It was somebody else. Anyway, that's what he did to visiting lecturers that he didn't like. And there were several of those. We had a, I forget how many we were on course, I suppose about 50, that sort of thing. All sorts. And because we were all sorts on all services and a number of different countries, the chances were that somebody on the course knew some famous or well-to-do, much more senior, much more distinguished figure in or out of the services. And the only one I'm going to mention was, and I can't remember who brought him in, but it was a soldier, I think. We arranged a sort of club, because there were several of these visiting people that could be got at if only they would agree to come. And the plan was that they would be asked to dine in the mess with us, and we'd all put on a black tie, not uniform. It would be entirely informed, entirely organized by this member of the course itself, not by the directing staff. And this was an extra, this was a bonus. And we'd have a perfectly normal, leisurely dinner, after which we would repair to the library, and over coffee, the guest would talk for about 20 minutes or so, maybe half an hour, but certainly no more, on completion of which we'd have a break, and he would have a glass of whiskey, and he would expose him, the guest would expose himself to questions. And this was really quite interesting. We had some quite interesting people. The one that stands out most to me was Mr. Tom M. Boyer of, was it Rhodesian fame? No, I don't think it was. It was, but anyway, it was thereabouts in Africa fame. I think it might have been Rhodesia. And they were due, the Rhodesians were due to go independent. And he delivers his lecture. He brought with him some dreadful bit of work he was to. It was a serving army captain of ours, I think he was a captain, might have been a half colonel, who he referred to as my man John. And my man John was the sort of the nanny. Tom and Boyer himself was very impressive, both as a person, as a nice guy, and as being a realist. He spoke fluent English, of course, and gave a very good lecture. And it was understood that the lecturer would be facing a no-holds-barred situation when it came to question time. And if he didn't like that, then he shouldn't have taken it on, and so forth. And when it came to questions, I remember one of our soldiers getting up, because they used that part of Africa extensively for training at the time. Our army did. And this chap said, now, when you go independent, you will lose all the revenue that you get from our army training in your country. And we shall lose our training grounds, and so forth. But if you remove that part of your revenue, what is left? And the answer must be nine-tenths of not much. And so on and so forth. And he really pitched in. And I will to this day remember Tom and Boyer's reply. He said, I think what you people over here don't understand is that the word independence is the be-all and end-all to my people. He said, they are not interested in where the money comes from. They're not interested in where the food comes from. They are interested in independence. And they are determined, and they've been promised it, they are determined that they are going to be independent. And if they starve, it will still have been worthwhile. And he said it with total sincerity. And I think he was doing little more than reflecting the general public opinion of his country.
And saying something like this in the late 50s would have had an enormous effect.
Yes.
Today it's almost taken as read, but then it would not have been.
But then it was not. No. It was early days. Well, en passant, looking back on it, my mind slightly dwelt on the various British lecturers that we had, and they were top people, and on the whole they were good. They varied enormously. I remember one, I think he was an Air Vice Marshal, might have been an Air Marshal, and he spoke very quietly, and he used a lot of expletives, and he was obviously a born rebel, and he had a very remarkable sort of dry, extremely funny turn of phrase. And I remember him saying this wasn't just a something or other a slip up, it was a monumental fuck up. and so forth. He had us in fits. And curiously, in my opinion, the two worst lecturers that we were subjected to